before. Automobile horns were honking. People were cheering as Orville stepped from his seat. At the same time, he was handed a letter from Wilbur. Orville smiled. It was the first letter he had received from his brother in 2 weeks, he said, and it seemed to please him quite as much as the triumphant flight he had just made. He had been in the air nearly an hour and 6 minutes, a new world record. To the crowd that quickly surrounded him, he seemed the coolest man around and entirely free from nervousness. Nor did he show any sign of fatigue. Indeed, seeing Lieutenant Frank Lum, one of the committee that would pass on the trials, standing nearby, Orville asked if he would like to go up while there was still some light left. So the two took off for a brief ride, just as a full September moon was rising. The day after, Orville set yet another record with a flight of an hour and 10 minutes, during which he thrilled the crowd with two figure eights. He tried one maneuver after another, as if he were an acrobat performing, at times turning corners so sharply that the plane seemed nearly on edge. "He dipped down low to earth," wrote a reporter for the New York Herald. "He skimmed it at twice a man's height. He rose steadily and gracefully until 150 feet of space lay between him and the ground. He all but brushed the trees in Arlington Cemetery. He tried every combination of the levers and planes in his run of 58 turns around the field. There was never a misfire of the engine, and never a symptom of distress." On Saturday the 12th, 5,000 people encircled the parade grounds. As they had never been able to do until now, the American people were seeing with their own eyes one of their country's greatest inventions in action. Among those who rushed to congratulate Orville was Octave Chanute, who, a bit out of breath, exclaimed, "Good for you, my boy," then asked him how it felt to be making history. "Pretty good," Orville said, "but I'm more interested in making speed." The remark made more headlines back in Dayton. It had not gone unnoticed that the Secretary of War was another of those who had come to see the demonstrations, and future weapons of war were very much on the minds of the officers at Fort Myer and figured prominently in their conversations. Buoyant with his successes, Orville would write to Wilbur, "Everyone here is very enthusiastic, and they all think the machine is going to be of great importance in warfare." A new book by the popular British novelist H.G. Wells featured a terrifying illustration of New York City in flames after an aerial bombing. "No place is safe. No place is at peace," wrote Wells. "The war comes through the air. Bombs drop in the night. Quiet people go out in the morning and see the air fleets passing overhead, dripping death, dripping death." Until now, the brothers had spent little time dwelling on such possibilities, not at least to judge by how very little they wrote or had to say on the subject. The excitement at home in Dayton was like nothing in memory, and at 7 Hawthorne Street especially, as Catherine recorded in a long Sunday letter to Wilbur. "Orv telegraphed after he made his long flight Wednesday morning. Our telephone rang steadily all evening. Everybody wanted to say something nice. I finally got to bed and had just dozed off when I was startled by the ringing of our doorbell. I bounced out and was halfway down the stairs when I realized what I was doing. I saw a man standing at our front door, so I went up to the keyhole and said, 'What is it?' 'I am from the Journal, and I would like to speak to Mr. Wright. I have a telegram which I think would interest him.' It scared me just a little because he acted as if he didn't want to tell me. I demanded, 'What is your telegram?' He said that the Journal had a telegram saying that Orville Wright had made a record-breaking flight. When he got that far, I discovered that he was the young idiot who had been out here once before to write up Pop and hadn't returned a picture that Netta loaned him. So I said, 'You can't see, Father. He's too old to be called up at such an hour as this. We knew about that before noon today. Now, the joke is that he had some news, the second long flight, and I wouldn't wait until he could tell it. I departed for bed and heard him talking through the crack in the door until I was on the stairs. The next morning, I found the picture which he had borrowed sticking in the front door screen. Maybe I wasn't wrathy at being waked up at that hour of the night. I didn't sleep again until after one. The mayor had come to see them. He wanted to appoint a committee to plan a grand welcome home for the brothers. People were wild over the idea. "Hasn't Orv had good luck with his motor?" she continued. "I'm afraid that your health as well as your motor is interfering with your doing your best. You are doing well enough, but we know that you would have made an hour-long flight long ago if you had had as good a chance as Orv. Since you didn't, I'm glad Orv did just what he did, to shut up the everlasting knockers. We hope every day that we will see that you have made a record. We know that there is some reason for it when you don't, and that makes us uneasy about your health. Those burns were so much more serious than we thought for a long time. That has pulled you down, I've no doubt. You look mighty thin in all the pictures." She had made up her mind that the bishop should go to Washington to see Orville Fly. She would go, too, but there was not money enough for both to make the trip. "Do you suppose we could scratch up the cash? Daddy has about $100. The bishop liked to preach the futility of craving fame. "Enjoy fame ere its decadence, for I have realized the emptiness of its trumpet blasts," he had written to Wilbur, and quoted favorite lines from the Irish poet Thomas Moore. "And false the light on glory's plume as fading lines of even." But for all that, he was as eager as the thousands in Washington to see Orville in action. "He wants to go, all right," Catherine wrote. That same Sunday, September 13, on the other side of the Atlantic, Wilbur wrote to tell Orville his sensation he, Orville, was in Europe. "The newspapers for several days have been full of stories of your dandy flights, and whereas a week ago I was a marvel of skill, now they do not hesitate to tell me I am nothing but a dub, and that you are the only genuine skyscraper. Such is fame." Wilbur's longest time in the air at Comte d'Avour, thus far, was just over 21 minutes, and only a week before, Léon Delagrange had made the longest flight ever in Europe, staying in the air slightly less than half an hour. He was having motor troubles, Wilbur explained, and the weather had been something fierce. To Catherine he reported that he had had almost as many congratulations on Orville's success as he himself had had a month earlier. But in a letter to his father, also written that same Sunday, Wilbur confided the real trouble was the constant fuss being made over him. It had become more than he could take. Everyone seemed a genuine friend and looked upon him as an adopted citizen of France. Nearly every evening, 2,000 or 3,000 people came to see if he would fly, and went home disappointed if he did not. One old man of 70, who lived 30 miles away, made the round trip on a bicycle almost every day for a week. The excitement and the worry and above all the fatigue of an endless crowd of visitors from daylight till dark had brought me to such a point of nervous exhaustion that I did not feel myself really fit to get on the machine. "I can't stand it to have people continually watching me. It gets on my nerves." As he explained to Catherine, he carried on his correspondence, sitting in his shed, the door locked to keep people out. Close to midnight in Washington, from the privacy of his room at the Cosmos Club, Orville wrote to Wilbur that he had never felt so rushed in his life, and that he had a stack of unanswered letters a foot high. To Catherine, he wrote that the weather, being what it was, would probably take another few days to quiet down. "In any event," he added, "I do not think I will make any more practice flights." In his brief time thus far at Fort Myer, Orville had set 7 world records. Rumors in Washington, and in an article in the New York Times on September 15, saying that President Roosevelt would soon announce his intention of going up in the plane with Orville, provided still more excitement. To many, it seemed perfectly in keeping with a president so given to the espousal of the unusual. 2 years before, he had startled the country by diving beneath the waters of Long Island Sound in a submarine. Of course, if the president asked me to take him on a flight, I cannot refuse, Orville said when reporters questioned him. However, he was not enthusiastic about the idea. I'm sorry, he said, I don't believe the President of the United States should take such chances. 2. On Thursday, September 17, the day was clear and cool. Wind conditions were ideal. The crowd, by the time Orville was ready to take off, numbered more than 2,600. Expectations were higher than ever. A young Army officer had been assigned at his own request to go with Orville as a passenger, as 2 other officers had already done, and to which Orville had had no objections. This time, however, the young man was someone Orville did not like or trust. Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge was a 26-year-old West Point graduate from San Francisco, with 2 eminent military figures in his family background with the same name, a grandfather and a great-uncle, both rear admirals. The great-uncle, Thomas Selfridge, had been the naval officer assigned in 1870 to survey the Isthmus of Central America to determine the place to cut a canal from the Atlantic to the Pacific. In little time, Lieutenant Selfridge had become one of the Army's most knowledgeable and enthusiastic aviation specialists. He was tall, handsome, and personable, and had been made a member of the Signal Corps Aeronautical Board. In addition, he was a member of what was known as the Aerial Experiment Association, or AEA, founded and headed by Alexander Graham Bell in the interest of progress in the design of flying machines, and that in particular troubled Orville. The young man had a good education and a clear mind, Orville had told Wilbur in a letter, but he was almost certainly a spy for Bell and the others of the AEA. I don't trust him an inch. Selfridge is endeavoring to do us all the damage he can behind my back, but he makes a pretense of great friendliness, Orville told his father. The thought of someone like that seated beside him in the air was not easy to accept. Selfridge also weighed 175 pounds, more than anyone Orville had yet taken up. Still, as a member of the appraisal board, Selfridge was clearly entitled to a flight, and so Orville had agreed. Looking extremely happy, Selfridge removed his coat and campaign hat, handed them to a friend, and took his place next to Orville, who was attired in his customary dark suit, starched collar, black tie, and Scottish plaid cap. Charlie Taylor and Charlie Furness turned the propellers to get them going, and at 5:14, the plane headed down the track and lifted more slowly than usual, it seemed to those watching. For 30 to 50 feet, it was barely above the grass before it began to creep into the air. The plane was at about 75 feet by the time it reached the lower end of the field, went neatly into its first turn, and came sweeping back at about 100 feet. It was noticed that Lieutenant Selfridge was apparently making an effort to talk with Mr. Wright, reported the Washington Post. His lips were seen to move, and his face was turned to the aviator, whose eyes were looking straight ahead, and whose body was taut and unbending. The plane circled the field 3 times at about 40 miles per hour. On the 4th turn, heading for Arlington Cemetery, Orville slowed down somewhat, and all seemed to be working well. Then, suddenly, just as the plane was passing over the aerial garage, a sizable fragment of something was seen to fly off into the air. "That's a piece of the propeller," shouted one of the Army officers. Orville would later describe hearing an unexpected sound, a light tapping behind him in the rear of the machine. A quick backward glance revealed nothing, but he slowed the engine and started toward a landing. Then, at an altitude of about 125 feet, came two loud thumps and a terrible shaking. Orville shut off the engine, hoping to glide to a landing. He pulled as hard as he could on the steering and lateral balance levers, but to no effect. Quick as a flash, the machine turned down in front and started straight for the ground. Lieutenant Selfridge, who had remained quiet until now, was heard only to say in a hushed voice, "Oh, oh." Those below watched in horror as the plane twisted this way and that, then plunged straight down, like a bird shot dead in full flight, in Orville's words. It hit the ground with terrific force, throwing up a swirling cloud of dust. A half-dozen Army men and reporters, along with Charlie Taylor, rushed out to help, led by three cavalrymen on horseback. Orville and the lieutenant lay pinned beneath blood-stained wreckage, faces down. Orville was conscious but moaning in pain. Selfridge lay unconscious, a great gash across his forehead, his face covered with blood. The scene around the wreckage became one of wild confusion. Officers were shouting orders, automobiles honking. Hundreds of people from the crowd who dashed forward had to be held back by the cavalrymen, one of whom was heard to shout, "If they won't stand back, ride them down." Several Army surgeons and a New York doctor in the crowd did what they could for the two men until the stretchers arrived, and they were carried off to the base hospital at the far end of the field. A reporter wrote of having seen Charlie Taylor bend down and loosen Orville's tie and shirt collar. Then, stepping back to lean against a corner of the smashed plane, sobbed like a child. Among the crowd that gathered outside the hospital as night came on were Charles Flint and Octave Chanute. Not until well after dark did word come from within the hospital. Orville was in critical condition, with a fractured leg and hip and four broken ribs, but was expected to live. Lieutenant Selfridge, however, had died at 8:10 of a fractured skull without ever having regained consciousness. His was the first fatality in the history of powered flight. Speaking for the Army Signal Corps, Major George Squire praised Lieutenant Selfridge as a splendid officer who had had a brilliant career ahead of him. But no one who had witnessed the flights of the previous days could possibly doubt that the problem of aerial navigation was solved. "If Mr. Wright should never again enter an airplane," Squire said, "his work last week at Fort Myer will have secured him a lasting place in history as the man who showed the world that mechanical flight was an assured success." That Orville's passenger that day could well have been Theodore Roosevelt was not mentioned. The telegram from Fort Myer arrived at 7 Hawthorne Street just after Catherine returned from school. Bishop Wright was in Indiana attending a church conference. There was never a question of what she must do. Moving into action without pause, she called the school principal, told her what had happened, and said she would be taking an indefinite leave of absence. Then, quickly as possible, she packed what clothes she thought she would need and was on board the last train to Washington at 10 that same evening. Bishop Wright, too, had received the news, but from the little he wrote in his diary, there's no telling how stunned or alarmed he was. Nonetheless, he excused himself from the conference and returned to Dayton without delay. Once there, he wrote to Orville, and clearly from the heart. "I am afflicted with the pain you feel, and sympathize with the disappointment which has postponed your final success in aeronautics. But we are all thankful that your life has been spared, and are confident of your speedy, though tedious, recovery, and of your triumph in the future as in the past. Then, in the way of a fatherly sermon, he added, "We learn much by tribulation, and by adversity our hearts are made better." It was 8 o'clock at Comte d'Avour, the morning of September 18, when Hart Berg arrived at Wilbur's shed to tell him the news. At first, Wilbur seemed not to accept what he heard. 1,000 people had already gathered at the field. The weather was ideal for flying, Le Mans more crowded than ever with people eager to see him fly. But out of respect for Lieutenant Selfridge, Wilbur postponed all flights until the following week. Then, shutting himself in his shed, refused to see anyone except Berg and one or two others who came to console him. "Now you understand why I always felt I should be in America with Orville," he said. "Two heads are better than one to examine a machine." Left alone, he sat with head in hands. When another friend came in, Leon Bollet most likely, Wilbur looked up, his eyes full of tears, and said if anything could make him abandon further work in solving the problem of flight, it would be an accident like this. Then, springing to his feet, he declared, "No, we have solved this problem. With us, flying is not an experiment. It's a demonstration." Others present saw him struggle with his emotions. He asked for fuller details, but there were none. Since coming to Comte d'Avour, he had acquired a bicycle on which he now went riding 8 miles to Le Mans in the hope of hearing further word from Fort Myer. For some time he could be seen pacing nervously about the porch at the Hôtel du Dauphin. "He felt very bad about this business," he told a reporter for the Paris Herald, who approached him. "It seems to me that I am more or less to blame for the death of poor Selfridge, and yet I cannot account for the accident. Of course, when dealing with aeroplanes, or indeed anything mechanical, there's always the possibility of something breaking, and yet we imagined that we had eliminated all danger. The thing which is worrying me more than anything is that my father, who is almost 80 years of age, will take this matter very much to heart. He has always been nervous about our trials, but up to the present he has never had occasion to be so." Toward dusk, Wilbur took his bicycle and rode back to Comte d'Avour. In a letter to Catherine written the following day, he told her he could not help thinking over and over that if he had been with Orville, the accident would never have happened. "I do not mean that Orville was incompetent to do the work itself, but I realized that he would be surrounded by thousands of people who, with the most friendly intentions in the world, would consume his time, exhaust his strength, and keep him from having proper rest. If I had been there, I could have held off the visitors while he worked, or let him hold them off while I worked. People think I'm foolish because I do not like the men to do the least important work on the machine. They say I crawl under the machine when the men could do the thing well enough. I do it partly because it gives me opportunity to see if anything in the neighborhood is out of order." He presumed their father was terribly worried about Orville's condition, he wrote in conclusion, but things would turn out right at last. Of this he was sure. At his upstairs desk in Dayton that same day, September 19, Bishop Wright wrote to Wilbur in much the same spirit. "It is sad that Orville is hurt, and unpleasant that his success is delayed. It is lamentable that Lieutenant Selfridge lost his life. I am saddest over his death. But success to your invention is assured. The brighter day will come to you." On Monday, September 21, at Comte d'Avour, Wilbur was back in action, taking the bull by the horns, as he liked to say, before 10,000 spectators. He flew 1 hour, 31 minutes, and 25 seconds, over a distance of 40 miles, establishing another sensational world record. Among the enormous crowd was the American ambassador to France, Henry White, who was reported to have been the most excited man present, and who, quite forgetting his usual diplomatic dignity, went racing across the field to be the first to shake Wilbur's hand. 3. Catherine reached Washington early the morning of September 18 and found Charles Flint and two Army officers waiting at the station, ready to drive her immediately in a Signal Corps automobile across the river to Fort Myer. At the hospital, she was met by the young Army surgeon and shown into Orville's room. "I found Orville looking pretty badly," she reported in a letter home to Lauren. "His face was cut in several places, the deepest of the gashes being over his left eye. He was so sore everywhere, he could not bear to be touched. His leg was not in a cast, as she had expected, but in a sort of cradle, held up by a rope to the ceiling," she wrote to Wilbur. "When I went in, his chin quivered, and the tears came to his eyes, but he soon braced up again. The shock has weakened him very much, of course." As the day went on, Orville turned extremely nervous and on edge. "I suppose the working with his leg has made him so. I bathed that side of his face that was exposed, and his chest and shoulders. That quieted him some." She liked the doctor and the male nurse on duty. The room, she was also pleased to report, was full of flowers, and there was a great basket of fruit and a pile of telegrams on a side table, including one saying, "The 1,000 proud pupils and teachers of Steele High School unanimously extend sympathy and encouragement." "I will acknowledge the notes and telegrams," she said. "There is a desk in the room, and I can sit there and write. After a bit, I can read to him." How long she would be staying was impossible to say. "He was not dangerously injured," she stressed, but she was sure it would be weeks before he would be able to leave. At first, she lived with a couple named Shearer, relatives of a Dayton friend. To get to the hospital from their home in Washington by trolley required 3 transfers and took fully an hour. Still, she was at Orville's bedside every day without fail. Some nights, too tired for the return trip to town, she slept at the hospital. Orville's progress was not steady. "Last night was a rather bad time for little brother, and this morning, too," she wrote to her father. "His leg was broken in 2 places," she explained, "but the breaks were clean and in as favorable places as they could be, in the thigh bone of the left leg. The doctors were making a great effort not to let the leg be shortened, and apparently they were succeeding. The broken ribs made it necessary to bandage him tightly, and that made his breathing hard. Tonight I'm staying all night with him. After I came today, he quieted down and was so much easier that I made up my mind to see him through the night. It is after 11 now, and he has been asleep nearly an hour. Last night codeine had no effect. Tonight it has." Her letter was written September 21, the same day Wilbur had made his record-breaking flight at Camp Dovor. "Will had his nerve with him sure enough," she wrote, knowing how her father must feel. 1 hour, 31 minutes, 25 seconds. All the newspaper men began calling up the hospital to tell me. Orville did a great deal of smiling over it. That did him an immense amount of good. "It's midnight now, and I'm very tired," she wrote at last. "Orville is still sleeping. The night nurse has gone down to get a sandwich and some tea for me." Meanwhile, the Army's Aeronautical Board had begun a formal investigation to determine the cause of the crash. "Orville thinks that the propeller caught in one of the wires connecting the tail to the main part," Catherine wrote. "That also gave a pull on the wings and upset the machine." As would eventually be determined, Orville was correct. One of the blades of the right propeller had cracked. The propeller began to vibrate. The vibration tore loose a stay wire, which wrapped around the blade, and the broken blade had flown off into the air. Because the stay wire had served to brace the rear rudders, They began swerving this way and that, and the machine went out of control. Until now, both of the Wright brothers had had close scrapes with death. Wilbur had crashed 2 times, with slight injuries. Orville 4 times, twice at Kitty Hawk and twice at Huffman Prairie. But as Wilbur wrote to their father, this was the only time anything has broken on any of our machines while in flight in 9 years' experience. Nor had either of them ever plunged head foremost straight to the ground from an elevation of about 75 feet. For Catherine especially, the one member of the family there at Orville's side seeing the condition he was in, it was truly a miracle he had escaped with his life. Charlie Taylor and Charlie Furness, the two Charlies as they had become known at Fort Myer, came to the hospital to show Orville the piece of the propeller blade that had broken away. The wreckage of the machine, they assured him, was secure in the shed, where the windows and doors had been nailed shut, and a guard stationed. They were packing the plane's engine and transmission parts that were undamaged to be shipped home. That accomplished, they too would be on their way. On September 23, Alexander Graham Bell and 2 members of his Aerial Experiment Association came to the hospital to see Orville, but learned he was not yet ready for visitors. The group then crossed the parade field toward Arlington Cemetery to view Lieutenant Selfridge's casket still awaiting burial. On the way, they stopped at the shed. Charlie Taylor, who had not as yet shipped the wreckage of the flyer back to Dayton, had taken a break for lunch. The only one on duty was the guard, who agreed to let the visitors into the building where the crate containing the flyer stood open, the wreckage on display. Bell took a tape measure from his pocket and made at least 1 measurement of the width of the wing. Word of this was not to reach Catherine or Orville for another week, but when it did, they were extremely annoyed. Catherine asked Octave Chanute for his view on the matter, and after talking to the soldier who had witnessed the incident, Chanute felt it was not something to be overly concerned about. When Charlie Taylor, on his return to Dayton, told Bishop Wright what had happened, the bishop, in a letter to Catherine, allowed it was very cheeky of Bell, but a very little piece of business anyway. No more was said of the matter, and exactly what Bell's intentions were was never made clear. Everyone at the hospital continued to be extremely kind and helpful to Catherine, and while she did not find the military hospital quite up to standards, no other hospital would have permitted her to stay there, and without a single restriction. The doctors and the day nurse were splendid. But having learned that the night duty nurse looked in on Orville only once every half hour, and that he was stationed on the floor below, she felt she had to be on hand for Orville. She stayed day and night, which Orville greatly preferred. Often he was delirious at night and could not be left alone. The strain on Catherine was taking a toll. "Brother has been suffering so much, and I am so dead tired when morning comes that I can't hold a pen," she wrote to Wilbur, in explanation of why he had heard so little from her. She fended off reporters and received visitors who were denied access to Orville. She continued to answer mail and telegrams, and it was she who represented Orville at the funeral ceremony on September 25, when Lieutenant Selfridge was laid to rest in Arlington Cemetery with full military honors. The role she had taken upon herself did not go unnoticed or unappreciated. Some of the press concluded that she had to be a nurse, and so described her. "Your sister has been devotion itself," wrote Octave Chanute to Wilbur. Most important by far, Orville told her he never could have gotten through the ordeal were it not for her. Others tried to show their empathy and respect in other ways. Alexander Graham Bell invited her to take a drive one evening along with Octave Chanute, after which they dined at the Bell home on 33rd Street in Washington. It was the only time she had been anywhere, she told her father. She was growing dreadfully homesick and worried over earning no income. "Have lost $82.50 already," she reported to Wilbur on October 2, knowing she still had a long time to go before a return to Dayton would be possible. Orville seemed to be improving, but was still in no shape to leave her home. The night of October 3, his temperature jumped to 101 degrees, and for no apparent reason. Orville was 37, but in his present condition, lying there, he looked older by far. The chances that he might ever fly again, or ever want to fly again, seemed remote, if not out of the question. Letters from home and letters from Lamont helped greatly. The postscript of one letter from Wilbur gave her and Orville both a particularly welcome lift. "I took Bolle 240 pounds for a couple of rounds of the field," he wrote. "It created more astonishment than anything I have done." "We are both fairly wild to get home," Catherine wrote to him. She had been thinking of going back for a week or so, if only to get some sleep. But then Orville would turn miserably uncomfortable, unable to get his breath. "I think I will have to stay until I bring him home," she wrote to her father on October 17, a month to the day since the crash. Orville continued having his ups and downs, which the doctors attributed to indigestion, so she began cooking for him, broiled steak, beef broth, soft-boiled eggs. When Walter Berry, the American attorney, who 3 years before had come to Dayton with the French delegation, invited her to dinner, she had to turn him down. She was refusing nearly all invitations, she explained to her father, being too tired to talk. By the last week of October, it was decided Orville should be moved to Dayton, not because he was sufficiently recovered, but in the hope that being back in familiar surroundings might help alleviate his nervousness. 3 days before he was to leave, two nurses helped him out of bed to try standing with crutches, and the blood rushed down within his left leg as if the leg were about to burst, and he nearly fainted. But on October 31, after 5 weeks and 5 days in the hospital, and with Catherine still at his side, Orville was taken aboard a train at Washington's Union Station. A good-sized crowd stood waiting at the Dayton station as the train pulled in the next morning. Catherine stepped out first onto the platform. Then Orville appeared on crutches, supported by two train officials. Many had come there to cheer the return of the man who had been instrumental in placing the fair name of Dayton before the eyes of the civilized world, wrote the Dayton Journal. But instead of cheers there was silence, and murmurs of pity and sympathy, so drawn and wasted did the hero look. No one was allowed to speak to him except members of his family. Her brother was still a very sick man, Catherine explained. Brother Lauren had come to the station to meet them, and a carriage stood waiting. But the vibrations on the train ride had been an agony for Orville, and any more of that in the carriage, it was decided, should be avoided. So he was moved slowly along the 12.5 blocks to Hawthorne Street in a wheelchair. Bishop Wright was at the house to greet them, and Carrie Kaler, who had been married and was now Carrie Grumbach, was on hand to prepare dinner. Orville's mind was good as ever, the bishop would record that night, and his body promises to be in due time. A bed had been set up for him in the front parlor. As for herself, Catherine allowed she was tired to death. In the days that followed, Orville still required a good deal of attention, as Catherine recorded, but was tolerably active, able to stay up longer through the day, sometimes for several hours. A local surgeon who looked him over found his left leg had been shortened about an inch, not the 1/8 of an inch he had been told at the Fort Myer Hospital. But with proper padding in the heel of his shoe, he should have no serious trouble. Neighbors, old school friends, came to call on Orville. By the second week in November, Charlie Taylor was pushing him in the wheelchair to the shop on 3rd Street, where the engine from the Fort Myer Flyer had been uncrated for inspection. "I have an awful accumulation of work on hand," Orville told Wilbur on November 14, in the first letter he had written since the accident. Home and a little work seemed to do exactly what had been hoped. So improved was he in health and outlook, and such was his progress walking on crutches, that by late December he and Catherine were letting it be known they would soon be sailing together for France to join Wilbur, Wilbur having told them they were needed. Chapter 10 A Time Like No Other. Every time we make a move, the people on the street stop and stare at us. Catherine Wright. 1. Wilbur's days at Le Mans had never been so full. In the months since Orville's accident, he had become an even bigger sensation. Not since Benjamin Franklin had any American been so overwhelmingly popular in France. As said by the Paris correspondent for the Washington Post, it was not just his feats in the air that aroused such interest, but his strong individuality. He was seen as a personification of the Plymouth Rock spirit to which French students of the United States, from the time of Alexis de Tocqueville, had attributed the grit and indomitable perseverance that characterized American efforts in every department of activity. The crowds kept coming to Le Mans by train and automobile, and from increasingly farther distances. "Every day there is a crowd of people not only from the neighborhood," Wilbur reported to Orville, "but also from almost every country in Europe." During the 6 months Wilbur was flying at Le Mans, 200,000 people came to see him. The thrill of beholding the American wonder in action, the possibility, perhaps even, to shake his hand or be photographed with him. The constant fuss made over him by young and old, men and women, were all part of the excitement, as was the sight of prominent figures daring to ride with him in the sky. First there'd been the rotund Léon Bollé, then Hart Berg, and after that Berg's wife Edith, who was the first American woman to go up in a plane. To avoid the embarrassment of having her long skirts lifted aloft by the winds, she tied them around her ankles with a rope. On her return, she said she had felt no nervous strain or the least bit of fear. Her admiration for Mr. Wright, strong as it already was, had increased tenfold by his master working of the machine. She would be ready any time, she said, to fly the English Channel with him. A photograph of Madame Berg, seated on the flyer at Wilbur Wright's side, beaming with pleasure in advance of takeoff, made an unprecedented magazine cover, and the famous Paris dress designer, Paul Poiret, quick to see the possibilities in the rope about the ankles, produced a hobble skirt that became a fashion sensation. Arnold Fordyce, who had led the French delegation to Dayton in 1906, took a turn to ride with Wilbur for a full hour, and for the chief of the French Army's aeronautical department, a Colonel Boiteux, Wilbur made several rounds at only 18 inches or so above the ground, which astounded everyone. Another passenger, like Edith Berg, marveled at how steady was the entire time in the air. "It seemed as if Wilbur and he were progressing along an elevated track," wrote an English officer, an aeronautical enthusiast, Major Baden Fletcher Smith Baden Powell, brother of the founder of the Boy Scouts. But he was astonished, too, by the noise. "Mr. Wright, with both hands grasping the levers, watches every move, but his movements are so slight as to be almost imperceptible. All the time the engine is buzzing so loudly and the propellers humming, so that after the trip one is almost deaf." A reporter from the Paris Herald took a turn, then another reporter from Le Figaro, then several Russian officers. "The accommodating attitude of this man, that we took great pleasure in depicting as a recluse, is inexhaustible," wrote the reporter from Le Figaro. Clearly, Wilbur was having a grand time. Queen Margarita of Italy was in the crowd yesterday, he wrote on October 9. You have let me witness the most astonishing spectacle I have ever seen, she told him. Princes and millionaires are as thick as fleas on the flyer, he added, knowing Catherine would love hearing that. That women found him increasingly appealing became quite evident. One highly attractive Parisian lady, the wife of a prominent politician, spoke freely and at some length to her reporter on the matter, with the understanding that her name would not be mentioned. Her first impression was not altogether favorable, she admitted. Monsieur Wright appeared a bit too rough and rugged. His expression was fixed and terribly stern. But the moment he opened his lips to speak, the veil of severity vanished. His voice is warm, sympathetic, and vibrating. There is a kindly look that imparts exceptional charm and refinement to his bright, intelligent eyes. The frank, honest way in which he looks straight in the eyes of the person to whom he speaks, and the firm grip of his wiry, muscular hand, seem to give true insight into his character and temperament. He impressed me as one of the most remarkable men I have ever met. Having finished the number of test flights required by the French syndicate, Wilbur began training the first of three French aviators, as was also required. He was the Comte Charles de Lambert, a slim, blond-haired, Russian-born aristocrat, age 43, who spoke English and to whom Wilbur took an immediate liking. With the plane fitted out with a second set of levers, he would ride to Wilbur's right. For his part, Wilbur would sit with his hands between his knees, ready if necessary to take control. Never had it been more important that Wilbur perform to perfection. For any mishap now, coming after Orville's crash, would be seen in a very different light, and so, as much as he was enjoying himself, the pressure on him was greater than ever. Only by escaping into the countryside on his bicycle could he have time to himself. How I long for Kitty Hawk, he wrote to Octave Chanute. In his honor, the Aero Club de France was planning its biggest banquet ever, at which Wilbur was to receive the club's gold medal and a prize of 5,000 francs, $1,000, and in addition, a gold medal from the Académie des Sports. I will have quite a collection of bric-a-brac by the time I return home, he wrote to Brother Ruchelin. What he valued still more, he said, was the friendship of so many of the good people of Le Mans. When he had arrived a few months earlier, he had known no one. Now he counted some of his warmest friends among those he had come to know. It seemed all the children within a dozen-mile radius would greet him as he rode by on his bicycle. They would politely take off their caps and smile and say, "Bonjour, Monsieur Wright." They are really almost the only ones except close friends who know how to pronounce my name, he told Ruchelin. People in general pronounce my name Wrecht, with a terrible rattle of the R. In many places I'm called by my first name, Wilbert, almost entirely. The Aero Club de France's banquet took place in Paris the evening of November 5, 1908, in the Salle du Théâtre of the Automobile Club on the Place de la Concorde. As reported, the brilliantly illuminated room had been transformed by plants and flowers in profusion. The 250 guests, nearly all men in full dress, included almost every major figure in French aviation: Léon Delagrange, Louis Blériot, Alberto Santos-Dumont, Ernest Archdeacon, in addition to Léon Bollée, Hart Berg, and Comte Charles de Lambert. Conspicuous, too, was the great structural engineer Gustave Eiffel. Among the few women present was Edith Berg. A military band provided appropriately rousing music, and as the guests read in the menus at each of their places, the evening's sumptuous feast included jambon de York au épinard, ham with spinach, Faisan rôti au crouton, roasted pheasant with crouton, salade russe, Russian potato salad, and glace à l'anina, pineapple ice cream. All was quite befitting the occasion, as a statement of national pride and the elegant taste of the time, and as recognition of an infinitely promising turning point in history. In presenting the gold medal, the president of the Aero Club, M.L.P. Kelate, spoke of the great change in public opinion that has swept over France and the world in general since Wilbur Wright began his performance at Le Mans. He spoke of how Wilbur and his brother had endured a period of ridicule and abuse such as had seldom been known in the history of scientific investigation. France, he said, was now at last showing its appreciation of their merit. Wilbur received a sustained ovation, and Louis Barthou, Minister of Public Works, delivered a hearty speech of congratulation, lauding Wilbur and Orville for achieving through straightforwardness, intelligence, and tenacity one of the most beautiful inventions of the human genius. Mr. Wright is a man who has never been discouraged, even in the face of hesitation and suspicion. The brothers Wright have written their names in human history as inventors of pronounced genius. Photographs were taken. Then Wilbur rose from his place at the center of the head table. Baron Estonel de Constant, translated as Wilbur spoke. For myself and my brother, I thank you for the honor you are doing us and for the cordial reception you have tendered us this evening. If I had been born in your beautiful country and had grown up among you, I could not have expected a warmer welcome than has just been given me. When we did not know each other, we had no confidence in each other. Today, when we are acquainted, it is otherwise. We believe each other, and we are friends. I thank you for this. In the enthusiasm being shown around me, I see not merely an outburst intended to glorify a person, but a tribute to an idea that has always impassioned mankind. I sometimes think that the desire to fly after the fashion of birds is an ideal handed down to us by our ancestors, who, in their grueling travels across trackless lands in prehistoric times, looked enviously on the birds soaring freely through space at full speed, above all obstacles, on the infinite highway of the air. Scarcely 10 years ago, all hope of flying had almost been abandoned. Even the most convinced had become doubtful. And I confess that in 1901 I said to my brother Orville that men would not fly for 50 years. 2 years later, we ourselves were making flights. This demonstration of my inability as a prophet gave me such a shock that I have ever since distrusted myself and have refrained from all prediction, as my friends of the press especially well know. But it is not really necessary to look too far into the future. We see enough already to be certain that it will be magnificent. Only let us hurry and open the roads. Once again, I thank you with all my heart, and in thanking you, I should like it understood that I am thanking all of France. At the point when Wilbur expressed his gratitude for the warm friendship he had experienced in a country not his own, his habitually rigid mask softened, according to one account. His voice, usually so clear, quavered slightly. The members and guests responded with a standing ovation. The band played the Star-Spangled Banner, and for some time afterward Wilbur stood patiently signing 200 or more menus. He knows the little chores that are incumbent upon our heroes to perform, observed the accountant Leirafil approvingly. In the weeks that followed, Wilbur returned several times to Paris to receive additional tributes and awards and to be hosted at more dinners in his honor. When not being celebrated at such gatherings, he could be seen striding alone up and down the Bois de Boulogne, or exploring the avenues, looking in the windows of curio shops, or standing quietly studying the architecture of one of the city's monuments. "He has a half-dozen invitations for every day," wrote a correspondent for the New York World, "and some few of them he accepts, putting on his hat and coat to go out and meet ladies and gentlemen who have spent an hour or two with their maids and valets in order to make themselves sufficiently beautiful for the honor of meeting him. They drive up in carriages and pairs with gold-braided coachmen and footmen, and Wright shoulders an umbrella for a walk through the rain to the house where the dinner happens to be. He is just himself in the most refreshing way." During an extended conversation with Wilbur one evening at the Berg's apartment on the Champs-Élysées, it became clear to the correspondent how greatly Wilbur enjoyed Paris. "He has too keen an appreciation of the beautiful not to do so." In early December, with winter setting in, Wilbur sent the Comte de Lambert to the southern reaches of France to look over the fashionable resort town of Pau, close to the Pyrenees Mountains, in the border of Spain, as a possible location at which to continue the demonstrations. It was where de Lambert had grown up, a town of some 34,000 people, known for its 14th-century castles, its fox hunting, and 18-hole golf course, the first on the continent, and what was considered one of the most appealing winter climates in Europe. The prospect of visiting a destination so popular with the high society of England and Europe might also, Wilbur hoped, further entice Orville and Catherine especially, to join him there for an extended stay. "A few months in such a place would do them both great good," he wrote to her. "I know that you love Old Steele," her high school, "but I think you would love it still better if the briny deep separated it from you for a while. We will be needing a social manager and can pay enough salary to make that proposition attractive. So do not worry about the $6 per day the school board gives you." But she had already made up her mind. "Brother and I are coming over as soon as we can," she wrote only a few days later, in advance of his letter reaching Dayton. She had only to make satisfactory arrangements for the bishop, who had just turned 80 and was not up to such a trip. In Paris, where new toys being sold were part of the street sights of the Christmas season, the most popular was a little reproduction of the Wilbur Wright airplane, of which much was made in the newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune. "It is quite a wonderful toy, for even the smallest details have been perfectly carried out, and the tiny machine will start from the ground, make its miniature flight, and then descend in a manner that is most remarkable. Mr. Wright himself is seated in the toy and operates it in the most lifelike way. The features of the inventor have a distinctly more Parisian than an American cast, but for all that, no one but knows for whom it is intended, and the sale of them has been quick and large." In Le Mans, despite increasingly cold days, Wilbur, having switched to wearing a black leather motorcycle jacket, was busy practicing takeoffs without the use of a catapult. He had decided to compete for the Michelin Cup, a prize newly established by the French tire company, and in the competition, such launching devices were not allowed. On the day of the event, December 31, the last day of the year, and Wilbur's last big event at Camp Dovor, in spite of rain and cold he was barely able to endure, he put on his most astonishing performance yet, flying longer and farther than anyone ever had. 2 hours, 20 minutes, and 23 1/5 seconds, during which he covered a distance of 77 miles. He won the cup. "He was sorry to have missed Christmas at home," he wrote his father the next day, "but I could not afford to lose the Michelin prize, as the loss of prestige would have been much more serious than the direct loss. If I had gone away, the other fellows would have fairly busted themselves any record I left. The fact that they knew I was ready to beat anything they should do kept them discouraged." After landing, he prepared to go up again, no matter the cold and rain, and this time he took the Minister of Public Works, Louis Barthou, with him. He informed me that the government had decided to confer the Legion of Honor